As the guns fell silent, the soldiers who had survived the Great War placed down their rifles and picked up their pens. And in that 20s and 30s period, so many war books were published. The memoirs of the Great War. What do they tell us about the experience of conflict? And how do we use them to find the old front line? Armistice Day is approaching, the time when we pause to remember the fallen from two world wars, and for many veterans of recent conflicts, a time for them to remember their service and their friends, their comrades who fell alongside them. But it's also a time to remember those who returned. I often describe them as the forgotten survivors of the Great War. The vast majority of those who went to war in 1914 came back. Even in the infantry, one in five were killed and three in five were wounded. That means most men returned. They might not have returned without a wound, and even if it wasn't a physical wound, they would have returned with memories that haunted them for the rest of their lives. I'm sitting here now in my new dining room, which has become a library, really, which will be hopefully my space where I'll record this podcast. And I'm surrounded by books about the Great War and the other Great War, the Second World War. But one of the many types of books that I have here are memoirs of the Great War, men who survived that conflict and went on to write about it. And that's what this episode will be about. So I'm going to be talking about books surrounded by books as well. And I'm looking up from the microphone and I can see two period Great War postcards that I've got up on the shelf there looking down on me. One of them is Eric Rupert Heaton. Eric probably needs no introduction on this podcast. I've spoken about him in several episodes and one of the video blogs, Walks the Hawthorne Ridge, where he was killed on the first day of the Somme. His story, his life, has lived with me most of my life and has inspired, I know, many of you to travel to the cemetery near Beaumont Hamel, Hawthorne Ridge number 1, to visit his grave to see where he is buried. And that postcard is precious to me. It was given to me by his sister all those years ago. So Eric looks down on me, and I think that's a nice thing when I'm recording these podcasts, to have these people that we speak about. We are so closely connected to them. Alongside him is another postcard of an even better known figure of the Great War, which I rescued from eBay some years ago, an original portrait of the Reverend, the Padre, PSB, Tubby Clayton. Tubby Clayton was an amazing character of the Great War, and I know I keep saying this, but he kind of deserves his own podcast episode, and that is something that we will return to. Moving books around, moving my archives around, I've found so many of these things that I haven't quite forgotten, but they remind me that they're there, and it just shows, I think, the depth of stories that there are about this subject, and that hopefully this podcast will continue to tell them. And this podcast to discuss memoirs of the First World War has been prompted by quite a few emails recently where you, listeners to the podcast, have contacted me to ask about what memoirs you should read. So I've responded to those, obviously, and I always really appreciate hearing from listeners, from people who listen to the podcast, are inspired by the podcast, and want to know more. And you will always get a response from me if you do email in, and I welcome that. And some of you have told me some amazing stories recently about some of your visits, and that's really great to hear as well. So I thought that rather than just reply to individual people, which I've done, let's have something a bit wider. And on this approach to Armistice Day, as we rightly remember the dead, we'll remember the survivors of the Great War and those who left testimony behind through these memoirs. So where do you start with Great War memoirs? If you start to look on Amazon or eBay or some of the kind of specialist book dealers, you'll find a lot of them. And that's hopefully kind of what we're going to do with this podcast. There are simply so many of them out there. And what we'll do is discuss them in two different categories, memoirs by officers and memoirs by ordinary soldiers. Now, we could also have a category with memoirs from other combatants from other nations, like Ernst Jünger with the Germans, for example. But again, I think that really deserves its own podcast, something about the memoirs of men from other parts of the battlefields or on the other side of the battlefields. There are obviously far fewer of those in English, plenty of examples in the original languages, but less so translated into English. And what we're going to discuss now is not an exhaustive list. I've literally not included every single memoir that I have. We would be here for multiple episodes doing that. The memoirs are something that I've always collected because in those early years of visiting the Western Front, through people like John Giles, John Drey, Richard Dunning, Martin Middlebrook, Lynn McDonald's, not just their own books, some of those are authors, of course, but they were very, very forthright in their view that the memoirs were part of the glue of the First World War. In our understanding of those battlefields, you needed to take on what I would now call layers of knowledge about the Great War, and the memoirs were one of those layers, that you could read these memoirs, read an account of going to Bazentin or an attack in the Ypres salient or an advance at Loos in 1915 and go to that bit of the battlefield with that account and connect it all up. And I think that making those kind of visits to the landscape of the First World War and adding that layer of memoir to it really brings those places alive. So we'll discuss those memoirs in those two different categories, officers and ordinary soldiers. And if we're going to discuss books and memoirs about the First World War, the obvious question is, where do you buy them? Now, back in the day, again, going right back to those early years of visiting the battlefields of the First World War, that was a time right across Britain where there were probably thousands of second-hand bookshops. You could go into almost every town, and in Sussex, a lot of villages had them as well. And there was a little tiny shop, oldie-worldie kind of shop, and you'd open the door and a little bell would ring, and inside were rows and rows of books, old books. And these bookshops were everywhere. And they had categories of books within them if they were a good one, so it wasn't just all kind of jumbled together, although I did go in a few shops like that over the years. And you'd go to the history section, and sometimes there would be a separate military section, but not always, and you'd kind of rummage through and see what you could find. And some of them used to have cabinets where the better books were located, often the more expensive books. So even then, if you were after kind of regimental or divisional histories, that's where they would be located. But even with memoirs, there were one or two written by famous individuals like Sassoon and Graves, who we'll discuss, where first editions were very valuable, and that's where you'd find them. But if you weren't bothered about owning a first edition, you could get one of the many trade editions and get books quite cheaply. And I would often, as a student, head off along the Sussex coast, visit a load of bookshops that I knew with a little 37 pattern Second World War large pack on my back, and with just not that much money in my pocket, go off and visit some bookshops and come back pretty much with it full. And you could pick up Great War memoirs for pence in some cases. I remember buying one or two memoirs for like 50p, 75p, the odd book for a pound. No one was really that interested in the Great War in the early 80s, and no one was collecting these books, so you could find them. And Sussex was a good place to do it for me because it was on my doorstep, but also it was a retirement area, so people would retire there, sadly pass away, and their houses would be cleared and the books would end up in the second-hand bookshops. Now, that's a lot more difficult now. There are still second-hand bookshops. I don't think you're going to be buying too many first edition Great War memoirs for tens of pence anymore, but there are shops and places out there where you can come, go and visit an actual physical shop and buy a book. But online, there are a lot of specialist dealers. Tom Donovan is one of them. I'll put a link to his website onto our podcast website. And I would add a warning to that. You could end up finding yourself spending quite a lot of your monthly income on these books if you're not careful. But Tom produces a regular list by email, which is a really good list with some really unusual books on it. But not just first editions. He also has more common books on there, which he sells at very reasonable prices. And he has a lot of stock on his general website as well. Now, I don't have shares in Tom Donovan's books, but I've bought a lot of books from him in the past, and I've known Tom for many, many years. He's a really nice, decent guy. Now, he's one of quite a few military book dealers out there, and it's just worth searching the internet for some more. eBay is another source of these books. It's surprising sometimes how cheap First World War books go for on eBay, so it's worth having a look on there to see what is available. The ultra rare books, you're not going to really find them at any kind of cheap price on eBay, I don't think. And of course, Amazon is there for reprints of these books, and companies like Naval and Military Press have reprinted a lot of these rarer First World War memoirs, particularly during that centenary period. So there's quite a few sources to find these, and again on the podcast website I'll put some recommendations for books that are still in print for you to seek out a few First World War memoirs if you've never read any. So we know what we're doing in this episode, looking at First World War memoirs, and we know where to get the books from, so let's discuss some. Our first look at Great War memoirs begins with those books that were written by men who were officers in the Great War. I've delineated this podcast into officers and other ranks because I think there's two different voices emerge from this. Officers, of course, were largely well-educated men, often with private funds, private means, and they had the time and the money to sit down and writes memoirs after the war without the impetus of having to be paid for it. So we see a lot more of memoirs emerging from former officers than we do ordinary men. And we'll return to the ordinary men part of it in the next part of the podcast. When we look at the memoirs of officers who served, we have to ask ourselves a number of questions. Do they speak for everyone is the principal question. Of course, they don't. And this is one of the dangers of memoirs, is thinking that particular books represent an entire generation. They don't. Books are there to give us voices. And as historians, we look at those voices and we make deductions from what we read. One book, one voice is not going to tell us the true story of the Great War. And if we're seeing memoirs as part of a layer of understanding the landscape of the First World War, it is important to look at multiple memoirs to get an understanding of that layer. So you can take, for example, a story of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers in a particular part of the line and look at that from the point of view of officers like Robert Graves and Siegfried Sassoon, who served with that regiment there, and then an ordinary soldier like Frank Richards, who was in the ranks. So you can't do that always, because there aren't necessarily multiple memoirs for every battalion or even regiment within the Great War, but you can sometimes, and it's important to do that. So let's begin our look at the officers' memoirs with what I would call the big hitters. And the big hitters are by some of the famous names of the First World War, of men who were writers, often professional writers, and also poets. And by that I mean Siegfried Sassoon, Robert Graves, Edmund Blunden, for example. So with Siegfried Sassoon, he was a very wealthy man. He had an enormous private income before the war. He privately published his poetry, but he was a patriot. He believed in service. He believed in duty. The war made him very cynical. If we read the history of Sassoon, we read about his protest against the war in 1917 that almost got him court-martialed. And his poetry, you can sense the bitterness in his poetry about the cost of war, the cost of sacrifice. He often asks what the sacrifice of the men who served alongside him, whether in the ranks or fellow officers, what was it for? But Sassoon has left us an incredible legacy of memoir. And it's not just memoirs of an infantry officer, which is his best known memoir of the First World War, which covers the pre-Somme period up to the fighting towards 1918. It's the earlier volume as well we have to connect to that, which is Memoirs of a Fox Hunting Man, which begins in the pre-war Sussex and Kent Weald, the countryside of southern Britain, and then leads up to the outbreak of war, where Sassoon joins as an ordinary soldier in the ranks of the Sussex Yeomanry, and then is commissioned into the Royal Welsh Fusiliers and goes off to the Western Front in the autumn of 1915, where he joins the 1st Battalion Royal Welsh Fusiliers in the trenches opposite Fricourt at Bois Francais. Now, we've spoken about these experiences there in previous podcasts, so I won't go over that again. But his books are the work of a professional writer, so they're highly crafted pieces of literature, well written, and I think very accessible. Sassoon is an easy read. He's not difficult. It's not full of too much language describing things. He sees the world and he records the world. And for me, that will always be part of the attraction of reading his accounts of the First World War, in the way that he talks about the landscape, riding in it, being in the trenches. And also there is that other layer of the men around him. Sassoon clearly had a great love of the men that he served with, and not just fellow officers. He went out and risked his life to bring in a wounded corporal, Corporal O'Brien, which would result in the award of the Military Cross. And it comes across very strongly how much regard he has for those ordinary soldiers that he serves alongside in the trenches of the Western Front. And Sassoon's journey across these battlefields from the Somme to Arras is something that you can use to follow in his journey today by visiting those battlefields and seeing the places where Sassoon was. And because he names people, he changes some of the names. So David Thomas, who was killed, shot through the neck at Fricourt at the Bois Francais and died. And there was that terrible moment where Sassoon and Graves stood by the graveside and watched the burial take place. He changes his name, David Thomas, to Dick Tiltwood in the book. So it can take a bit of deciphering to work out who some of these real people are, but there are several other books that complement this that will help you do that. But I think even if you don't want to find the real people, Sassoon in your pocket when you visit the Somme is not a bad deal, really, and something that I would highly recommend. So Sassoon, I think, is at the kind of pinnacle of these well-educated, well-versed, well-read and highly gifted writers who wrote their memoirs of the First World War. And it's not surprising to discover that his books became bestsellers and went into multiple editions and are still in print now, a century nearly after he first published them, which is some achievement, really. And looking at those other big hitters, Robert Graves, who was originally commissioned into the Welsh Regiment and then was transferred to the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, served with Sassoon for a short while in the 1st Battalion and then was sent off to the 2nd Battalion, and he was wounded at High Wood. We did an episode about books and battlefields where we followed him on the ground around Bazentin and High Wood. And on one of my earliest trips to the Somme, I put a copy of Goodbye to All That, which is his memoirs of the Great War, into my knapsack and walked the Somme battlefields with it and read it at different places when I was walking that ground with my dad in 1982. And when I got back, I discovered that Graves was still alive, and I wrote to him through his publishers, but he never responded. And I discovered some years later that in the last years of his life, he totally rejected the Great War. He wanted to forget about the war. He didn't want to be seen as a war poet. He wanted to be known as a love poet. And that probably explains why he never replied. Probably he was bombarded with letters, and one from a teenager talking about the Great War was the last thing that he was going to give any kind of concern to. But the book had a strong effect on me. It begins, again, like Sassoon, before the Great War, with Graves going through this traditional public school education. Again, he came from a wealthy family. His middle name was von Ranker. His mother was German. And we sense, as you read the book, Graves is quite honest about things, and he upsets people as he goes along. I pretty much think that throughout his life, he upset everyone that he ever knew. He fell out with Siegfried Sassoon, for example, over the publication of their respective books. But what you get from this is an honest, detailed account of being a subaltern, a junior officer on the Western Front. And again, you can sense from it the love he has of his men. They're not just kind of chess pieces in his life. It's much more than that. And it gives you this detailed account, in particular, again, of the Somme. So Sassoon and Graves, both serving in the same regiment, both covering similar areas of the Somme battlefields. This is all part of our understanding of the men who were there and the stories of those who were there, obviously from an officer perspective, but it's a good way to tramp those battlefields with those books in your pocket. The other big hitter, as I've called them, is Edmund Blunden. Now, he was from Sussex. He served with the 11th Battalion, the Royal Sussex Regiment, the 1st South Downs Battalion, a battalion that is very close to my heart, that I've researched as part of those three South Downs battalions that served in the Great War, being from Sussex myself. And Blunden was a junior officer that went over as a replacement in the early part of 1916, before the attack at Richebourg and the Somme. And his book follows through from that Richebourg period through the Somme, through the South Downs being at Ypres and the Third Battle of Ypres Passchendaele. And then his story concludes when he transfers to another battalion just prior to the German offensive in March of 1918. Blunden, compared to Graves and Sassoon, although he was from a reasonably wealthy background, not super rich, but they were comfortable, they had servants, they lived in quite a big house in Sussex. And of course, he'd been privately educated at Christ Hospital School near Horsham in Sussex. Blunden is a more gentle soul, I always think, that he describes much more about the landscape and the nature and what he sees in the smashed villages. And we've had a couple of episodes where we've linked him to some specific places on the Somme. And I read it because, again, he mentions a lot of ordinary soldiers. He mentions them by name. And one or two of the people that he mentions in his book, over the years, I have photographs or I've picked up their medals. So it's quite interesting to have that kind of connection to a book. And again, you can follow these individuals through the battlefields. He mentions men who were killed and you can find their graves and you can link together the places from the redoubts at Festubert, where he was in the big open fields there as it is today, through to the Boar's Head, the battlefields around Richebourg, down to the Somme at Hamel, where he was, and the Schwaben redoubt. It's a great way, again, of connecting up those places. And in his case, because he had a much kind of wider service than Graves and Sassoon, he was in the front line a lot longer than both of those without being seriously wounded. He connects us to a greater range of different places on those battlefields of the First World War. And I think it's sometimes harder to read his book, but I find it more rewarding in some respects than either Sassoon or Graves in terms of what it gives us for our travels across that landscape of the Western Front. So those are three of the big hitters, and they became men who were well known for not just their books about the Great War, but for different aspects of their life and the things that they did, particularly with Graves writing so much more material and Blunden becoming one of the greatest poets of the 20th century in Britain. But those are the big hitters. What about some lesser-known officer memoirs of the First World War? Those books are easy to find. These ones, less so. So let's start with some of those. One I would always initially recommend is Sidney Rogerson's 12 Days. Rogerson served as an officer in the 2nd Battalion, the West Yorkshire Regiment, and the book covers a very, very short period at the fag end, at the end, the autumn of 1916, the end of the Battle of the Somme. It literally takes 12 days out of a period of service when the battalion was in and out of the line. It begins behind the line, near to Albert at the Citadel camp, and then moves up to the frontline area on the Le Transloy ridge near to the village of Le Boeuf. And it describes not big battles, not going over the top, but static warfare in a quieter period of the Somme battlefields. And there's huge amounts of detail in this book which Rogerson describes, and you get this sense again of his men, not just the officers in his battalion, but the men. And he talks, for example, about one man who's a bit of a scrounger who likes to go out into no man's land at night and see what he can find on the bodies of the dead. And he allows him to do this on the condition that he searches for the dog tags, the identity discs, of British soldiers who are lying out there dead and bring them in so they can use that as proof that they've been killed to relieve some of the misery of their families when these men have been posted missing. So you get kind of lots of cameos like that in Rogerson's books. And in the first edition of it, there are a whole series of paintings, illustrations that he did to illustrate some of the aspects of the story within it. Now, the first edition is not desperately expensive. It can easily be found in a number of different places. And there is a reprint as well. I think Tom Donovan may well have done a reprint at one stage, and then Naval and Military, I think, did one. But it's still out there, the book. And I think when you take it to that part of the forgotten Somme, where there aren't that many cemeteries or memorials, it's just vast open fields along that La Transloy Ridge, and you sit there, you can walk up to, for example, where there is a memorial at the Caribou outside Gerdecourt and look across that landscape and read Rogerson's accounts of the conditions, what it was like in the trenches. I think that's where the writing connects you to the landscape, connects you to the history, connects you to those layers of the First World War in that part of the Somme. I then say go to Francis Hitchcock's Stand To, A Diary of the Trenches. Hitchcock served with the 2nd Battalion, the Leinster Regiment, and it follows him from the Ypres Salient in 1915 through to the final phase of the war with the 4th and final Battle of Ypres in the autumn of 1918. Along the way, he fights on the Somme and around Arras. And the book is based on his diaries. It's kind of written in a diary format, but he illustrates it with some little sketches and also maps. And this is another really interesting aspect of some of these memoirs that have maps in them, is that makes it incredibly useful if you're then going to tie that to the landscape to take those maps with you and walk that ground. And I remember taking a library copy of Stand To when I couldn't afford to buy it to the local photocopier and photocopying all the maps and putting them in my knapsack as I headed off to the Somme and Ypres to follow Hitchcock around those parts of the battlefields. And again, there's lots of stories in it where you can read about real people getting killed or wounded. And there's one instance where he talks about men going out into a field near Ypres, and they go out to get some scrounge and potatoes that are in the field to make some grub with it, and they get killed. And those men, you can find their graves in La Belle Alliance Cemetery close to Ypres. And we mentioned Ernst Junger, a German veteran who wrote Storm of Steel and Cops 125. At one stage, Hitchcock in the 2nd Leinsters was at Guillemont, opposite Junger's unit, who was holding the Sunken Lane area there. And this is one of those cases where we've got accounts of a battlefield from both sides. Hitchcock with the Leinsters on the British side of No Man's Land, and Junger with the Germans and the Hanoverians on the other side of No Man's Land. So it's another way of kind of weaving in through, again, these layers. We're going to hear me talk about these layers a lot in this podcast, and the books are all part of that. So Hitchcock, for me, was particularly the Ypres salient parts of it, was a really useful way of understanding those battlefields, to walk the ground, to walk that curve of the salient, visit some of the sectors where he served around Hoog, and then read his account of it and really get into the detail of what life in those trenches was like during those long, long periods of static warfare. Now, returning to the Somme battlefields, and the book's not just about the Somme, but the next book that I recommend from an officer's memoir point of view is Charles Dewey's The Weary Road. The Weary Road was originally published, I think, in the 20s. It's been reprinted quite a few times. And Dewey served in the 1st Battalion of the Dorsetshire Regiment for a long time of his service period. That was part of the 32nd Division. And he was with them on the Somme before the Somme offensive began. And there's a lot of description of raids and counter-raids and periods of static warfare in the build-up to the Battle of the Somme. And it's really good for that. And then he was there during the Somme fighting when his battalion went into action at the beginning of the Battle of the Somme. And then he described some of the later conditions as well. But his battalion moves up and down the front, and at one stage he's right up on the coast at Newport, and there's some really great descriptions of that part of the front line, the beginning of the Western Front on the beaches there at Newport. So it covers quite a wide period and a wide part of the battlefields, but the Somme parts of the book are really among the best. And the way he connects again to his comrades, the men he fought with, those who died alongside him, and he describes in the village of Auteuil, on that sloped, tiered little cemetery, Auteuil Military Cemetery, and the dead who are buried there. And he describes how him and his fellow comrades were masters of the fields and the woods. And he says how one day no English-speaking person will ever return there, and the woods, the fields, and the places that have cost so much in terms of the fallen and blood will be empty and silent. And in that, of course, he's wrong. Here we are with a podcast, one of several podcasts about the battlefields of the First World War, and those battlefields are far from quiet. So I hope that if, wherever Dewey is, he might look down and see that he was wrong in that respect. But the book is beautifully written and incredibly moving in places, and is an absolute masterpiece. It's, in terms of the lesser known officer memoirs of the First World War, it's really up there in the top five in my view, and one that really I would recommend that you read as soon as you can. So looking at some other officer memoirs, Graham Seaton Hutchinson has to be in there somewhere. Hutchie, he wrote quite a lot of books about the First World War, his experiences in the First World War, different aspects of it. He became a member of the British Union of Fascists in the interwar period, and I once in a bookshop turned up his book, I think it's called Meteor, where he describes kind of his view of white supremacy. Not a very pleasant book to read at all. So there was a dark side to Hutchie. But his book Warrior, which describes his experiences first as a machine gun officer in the Scottish Rifles, and then he's transferred to the Machine Gun Corps, eventually becoming a battalion commander in the 33rd Battalion, 33rd Division machine gun units, is a classic kind of following that type of unit, a machine gun unit across the Somme, up to Arras and through the battles of Third Ypres, and the key period in March and April of 1918 when Hutchie's battalion is up on the Huguenacker Ridge during the Battle of the Lys. It's a detailed and well-written book, easily accessible, not difficult to read at all. A lot of people and places are mentioned in it, so you can link all that up with your battlefield visits and the landscape of the First World War. And it's clear, I mean, there are some very moving parts in it where the young soldier who dies in the quarry at Bazentin, and that's the only time a soldier to his face called him Hutchie, his nickname in the unit. There are some very moving parts, and Hutchie is kind of one of those lodestars, really, that you can follow around the battlefields. You can go to place and think, well, Hutchie's unit was there, or he describes that. But there is this darker side to him. He's not a pleasant individual in some respects, and I'm not sure that I would ever want to have sat down at a table with him. But the book is worth reading, and he wrote a number of others. As I said, one of them is called Pilgrimage, which he talks about the battlefields of the First World War in that interwar period, and he wrote it as an inspiration for veterans to go and travel those battlefields themselves. Now, Hutchie was a bit of a fire eater in the terminology of the day, a bit of a go-getter, and another one of those was Arthur Pollard, who served first as an NCO in the Honourable Artillery Company, then was commissioned in that unit, became a captain by the end of the war, and picked up the Victoria Cross and the Military Cross along the way. And he wrote a book called Fire Eater, Memories of a VC. And that follows him again from the Ypres salient through to the Somme and Arras and the battle in which he won the Victoria Cross, and then the final engagements of his unit, which was part, for a big chunk of that time, of the Royal Naval Division. In the earlier period, it had served with, I think, the 3rd Division up on the Bellawada Ridge and around Hoog. And there's some really good descriptions of that part of the battlefield. And again, you can see how useful all these different books are by kind of piecing them together. You've got Hitchcock with Stand To talking about being in the trenches at Hoog in 1915 as an officer and describing that. And you've got Pollard, although he later became an officer, he started in the ranks as a sergeant. And you can read about his description of being in no man's land and serving in that part of the same sector. So you can begin to see these different voices and piece together a kind of mind picture of that part of the battlefield. So when you stand there on the Bellawada Ridge or you walk up the Menin Road towards Hoog, you've got a greater understanding of what it was like there. Now, Pollard was an unusual character in some respects. We tend to think that men didn't really like their military service or wanted the war to end and go home, and I'm sure most of them did. But Pollard was one of those who thrived in the war. He says in the book that he was never happier than when he was in no man's land with a Lee Enfield rifle in his hand hunting the Germans. So it's a different perspective of the war. This is a man who clearly enjoyed the war, got a lot out of it, and possibly didn't really know what to do with himself once the war had ended. So it's an unusual book in that respect, but well worth reading because of the different parts of the front that he describes throughout the book. If Pollard was the fire eater, a very contrasting character to him was Charles Carrington. He was a junior officer in the Royal Warwickshire Regiment, the territorial battalion of that unit, and under the name of Charles Edmonds, he published A Subaltern's War in the 1920s, a book that again has remained in print pretty much on and off ever since. It's a more gentle account of the war, but a very, very good description, again with some maps in it, which is really, really useful, of the quiet sectors on the Somme before the Somme began, being in the front line on the 1st of July, and then going into action at Pozières. And you can walk that ground that he and his battalion fought over from Overlers up towards Pozières and stand there with his book and read those accounts of that open landscape around the village of Pozières and what it was like to be there before the Australian attack went in, which took the village. And then he took part in the advance to the Hindenburg line, so it was around Peronne, and then the fighting on the Western Front in 1917. Now, he was also one that enjoyed his war, but not kind of overly enjoyed it, perhaps, in the way that Pollard did. And I was lucky to speak to Charles Carrington at an early meeting of the Western Front Association at the National Army Museum in the early 1980s. And I remember him being interviewed for a programme where he really wanted to kind of hammer home that not everyone had had a bad war. I think he used the phrase, "The quartermaster never stole my rum." And what he meant by that was that, you know, not every soldier was a rogue, not everyone had this terrible experience. Although the war was hard and they lost many comrades and it remained with them always, for some it was a defining and important moment in their life. And I think that's what he was trying to get across. And this book is, again, like I say, a gentle book, but it gives you so much. You can really kind of feel the experience of that battalion and, more importantly, link it to the landscape as it is today. And another memoir links us to the same regiment, Territorial Battalion of the Royal Warwickshire Regiment, same brigade, same division, 48th South Midland Division, that Charles Carrington served in. And this book is Some Desperate Glory by Edwin Campion Vaughan. Now, this was published much later. Campion Vaughan died before the Second World War. I think he died tragically on an operating table when a routine operation went wrong. And he'd written this account that wasn't published until the 1980s by Leo Cooper. And it's been reprinted quite a few times since. It covers similar stuff he joined towards the end of the Somme. And it looks at his experiences in the German withdrawal across that area in early 1917 in the advance to the Hindenburg line. But the real kind of key chapters is when he gets to the Third Battle of Ypres and he describes the attack near St. Julian across the Steenbeck River. Now, I've stood there many times with groups, ledger groups, and read his account of the conditions on that battlefield and how at one point he goes forward and he sinks into the mud and there's a tremendous noise of the bombardment and he's shouting out as he's sinking deeper into the mud, calling to his men to come back and pull him out, and they can't hear him because of the bombardments and he fears he's going to somehow drown in this mud. So he uses his pistol to fire into the ground near to their feet, which makes them stop and turn round and see that their officer is about to go under, so they pull him out. It's truly horrific in some ways when you read just how terrible these ground conditions were during the Third Battle of Ypres, and this is one of the best accounts of it. So that description of the fighting in what we'd call the Battle of Passchendaele, erroneously, but the Third Battle of Ypres, really makes it one of the best, I think, accounts of that period of the war, that part of the battlefield, and great for walking that ground. You can walk up from Ypres and approach the Steenbeck River close to St. Julian, walk up alongside it, and you can stop and you can read Campion Vaughan's account of that part of the front line. Now, in the 1970s and 80s, quite a few officer memoirs came out then. Often, it was a period in which there was almost no interest in the First World War, and they kind of dive-bombed in terms of sales. And I remember going into remainder bookshops and second-hand bookshops in Brighton, for example, where there would be big piles of these books. They're much harder to get now. I think a lot of them ended up being pulped. But there's three from that period that I particularly want, or three authors that I want to pick out. And one of them is R.B. Talbot Kelly, who wrote A Subaltern's Odyssey, Huntley Gordon, who wrote The Unreturning Army, and P.J. Campbell, who wrote two books, In the Cannon's Mouth and The Ebb and Flow of Battle. R.B. Talbot Kelly was a gunner officer. He was a forward observation officer in the Royal Field Artillery in the 9th Scottish Division. And his book covers the Battle of Loos, the formation of the 9th Scottish Division, their travel across to France, and then their first action in the attack on the Hohenzollern Redoubt on the 25th of September 1915, superb descriptions of the Battle of Loos, some of the best from the viewpoint of a gunner officer. And being a gunner officer, he got to see a lot more of the battlefield, travelling around, acting as a forward observer. And the book moves on to the Somme, and there's a lot about Arras and the Third Battle of Ypres. Really brilliant accounts. Again, this is one of those that has travelled with me on the battlefields many times. And it's got some sketch maps in it, and also he was a professional artist. I have one of the books that he wrote and illustrated about birds, for example, one of these puffin books from, I think, the 1930s. And the little illustrations, I think a big chunk of them are now in the collection of the National Army Museum. They are really good little illustrations, and again, a kind of a bonus. So if you're following him around on the battlefields and you get to the area at Loos where he was, and he talks about Tower Bridge, the big lifting gear from the mine there, and he does a little sketch, and you can stand there on that ground and look at his sketch. So it's, again, one of these books that helps you connect to these multiple layers of how we understand those battlefields of the First World War. Huntley Gordon was another gunner officer who served in an independent field artillery brigade, so they weren't attached to a particular division, and they moved around a lot. He was with the Royal Field Artillery at Arras and Ypres, and his book, The Unreturning Army, covers those periods. I love it particularly for his descriptions of the ground around Zillebeek. And again, I've walked all that, walked up to the points where he had his observation posts. He was another forward observer. And he describes the whole landscape around Hoog, the Menin Road, the Belawada Ridge. Now, we've got Hitchcock's account from 1915, Pollard's account from a similar period. And now we've jumped on to 1917, and now we've got Huntley Gordon's account of the same area. And again, you can see how useful these different memoirs are for connecting up those jigsaw pieces to understand a particular part of the battlefield. And you can literally kind of follow him on a little walk up through Zillebeek, up onto the high ground above, looking down onto the Menin Road, around to Maple Copse and Observatory Ridge, and you can do a kind of Huntley Gordon walk, reading the book as you go along. Really, really excellent account, well written. I've read it many, many times. You can just dip in and out of it, and it's been reprinted. There's a new version. I think his son brought out a new version during the centenary, which is easily available with some extra material in it. So that's another good one. And these gunner officer memoirs, of which there are quite a few, and we've only mentioned a couple of them, are really good because being, as we said, being gunners, they got to move around a lot more and they saw a lot more of the ground. And men like them had maps and air photos and oblique photographs and panoramic photographs and all the kind of material that they could probably keep and take home with them and then use to write these books. And they also, during the war, they saw a lot more of the landscape of the battlefields and what was going on than the ordinary platoon commander in an infantry battalion in a frontline trench. So the gunner memoirs, always very, very interesting and useful. PJ Campbell is another gunner officer. So all these three, the commonality is the artillery. He served also in an independent brigade of the Royal Field Artillery, and his two books, In the Cannon's Mouth and The Ebb and Flow of Battle, cover 1917 and 1918 respectively. In the Cannon's Mouth is about Passchendaele, Third Ypres and the battlefields there. Brilliant account of that. The conditions, what it was like to use the guns there, the men in his field artillery brigade and being in and out of the line around Ypres. It's a classic book looking at the landscape of the Ypres salient. The Ebb and Flow of Battle covers the two German offensives of March and April of 1918, which he was involved in, and there's some great descriptions of pulling back as an artillery field brigade with the Germans hot on your heels. He describes firing over open sights with the guns, kind of gunner's worst nightmare, and in particular, I love his description of the area in April 1918 as they pull back over the Messines Ridge towards the Scherpenberg and those hills as you get towards the Franco-Belgian border. That's a brilliant description of that period of the war and what the fighting was like there, more fluid fighting. And then it moves on to the last 100 days, and it's a really good memoir to connect you to some of those battlefields of the First World War. And PJ Campbell was still alive when I began my interest in the Great War. He appears in Frederick Forsyth's series called Soldiers that was on, I think, ITV or Channel 4 in the 80s. And I tried to track him down but failed, sadly. I would have loved to have spoken to him because those two books, I read Ebb and Flow of Battle and read it again and again. They're brilliant books. Absolutely love those two. And they need to be in the knapsack, I think, of any kind of great war enthusiast to understand those battlefields of 1917-18. So I'll just end this section on officers' memoirs with two final books. I mean, I could go on and on with all these books, and I'm thinking, I haven't mentioned this one and I haven't mentioned that one. But we want to give you a kind of an intro into these memoirs, and you can begin with these books that we've mentioned and then broaden yourself out as you find more. But there's one that's easy to find, and that's Of Those We Love by I.L. Reid. I've mentioned this book a few times in the podcast. He was a Sussex lad from Eastbourne who was on an apprenticeship in Leicester when the war broke out, and he joined the Leicestershire Regiment, the Leicester Pals, and served with them at Bazentin. His descriptions of the fighting at Bazentin Wood are really second to none. And he was also a really good illustrator, and the book's illustrated with his sketch maps and illustrations of the front line. He also links into Junger, Ernst Junger, who we mentioned, because he's in the area of a Christmas truce between the Leicesters and the Hanoverians near Monchy-au-Bois, north of the Somme, in the winter of 1915-16. So it's good for that. And then he gets commissioned in the Royal Sussex Regiment, and he serves with them in the Second Battle of the Marne and the Fourth Battle of Ypres in the autumn of 1918. And it is one of the very few first-hand accounts of the Second Battle of the Marne. So it's a very important book from that point of view. It was privately published in the 90s, and I think it was Pen and Sword did a reprint since. So it's easy to get hold of. Really, really good, detailed, well-written, and again, kind of gentle memoir of the First World War. You can see again the sense, because he'd served in the ranks himself, he had a very different opinion of what it meant to be an officer. And I think you see that reflected in the book. And we'll end with a really obscure book on the First World War, a memoir of the First World War, and that is Q6A and Other Stories by Francis Buckley. Buckley served as an officer in the 7th Battalion Northumberland Fusiliers in the 50th Northumbrian Division, and the book covers a period from 1916 to 1918, starting in the Ypres Salient, where they were prior to the Battle of the Somme. They were on the southern sector, on the Messines sector. There's a lot about that, Hill 60. He mentions Jack Dorgan, MM, who was a veteran of the Great War that I knew. It's really lovely to see his name mentioned in the book. And there's a lot about the experiences of his unit on the Somme around Martinpuis and the Fleurs-Corselet period of the fighting, and then Arras and the Third Battle of Ypres. It was a very limited print run. The one I've got is a numbered copy of about 250, and I think he signed, my one signed by him, and there were, I think they were all signed. So it was a very difficult book to get hold of. I chanced across a copy in one of my favourite little bookshops in Hastings that I used to visit in the 1980s. And I didn't really realise how rare it was. But it has been reprinted, and I'm pretty sure there's a digital version you can download from the Internet Archive onto a Kindle as a PDF or something like that. But it's a really good book. It's not as well written as some of the other memoirs that we've talked about here, but the detail in it and the way you can link it in particular to the areas around Ypres is incredibly useful for making visits and connecting up these stories to the battlefields and the landscape as it is today. So that's a selection of officers' memoirs from the First World War. Only a tiny selection. And I'm conscious of the time. I said we could probably have multiple podcasts talking about these books. But hopefully that's given you a few pointers as to what to read. And I'll list them all on the podcast website so you can see them. And the ones that are still in print, I'll put on there as links to where you can find them on Amazon. So that's officers. And we'll move now on to memoirs of ordinary soldiers. Having suggested some memoirs written by officers who'd served in the Great War, we'll now look at those written by ordinary soldiers, men who served in the ranks. And once you start to look into this aspect of Great War memoirs, you realise that there are a lot fewer of these than there are for officers. So why is this? Why are there fewer accounts written by ordinary soldiers compared to those who were commissioned? Well, education is one part of it. I think there are many people who perhaps believe that the generation of the First World War was still kind of semi-literate. But education reforms in that kind of late Victorian into the Edwardian period meant that actually they were a very literate generation. You see it in the service records, everyone is able to write their own name, and the style of handwriting you see, even from ordinary soldiers, is very, very good. And the huge amount of letters that went back and forth and back and forth between men on active service and those at home, which you often see reproduced in local newspapers, indicates that generally this is quite a literate generation. And the huge amount of diary keeping, especially by ordinary soldiers, they could go into canteens at camps and shops at camps when they were training in Britain. And one of the things they could buy was a little pocket diary. I have a few examples of these myself. And men kept diaries, even if it was just basic little notes about where they were and what they'd seen. So it's not that they're not literate, but particularly things like the infantry are drawn from a working class background, soldiers from a working class background. And those kind of men are less likely to be inspired to write an account of their life. They're almost kind of taught to believe that they're just a cog in a wheel. Who would be interested in their experiences? Whereas Sassoon and Graves and Blunden and so many others, having gone to public school, kind of made to feel special that they were part of this kind of golden generation, it doesn't even cross their mind that they should write a book about it, about their life, their experiences in the trenches. So I guess there's a kind of reluctance for ordinary soldiers to do this, but you see it begin to change. 20 years after the Great War, there was a series of magazines published called The Great War I Was There, which did use some material from published books, but also commissioned material. And you see quite a representation from ordinary soldiers in things like that. And there was a book published called something like 500 Cockney Stories of the Great War, most of which were from ordinary men. Now, when it comes to published memoirs, there are fewer, but there are some really good ones. And in this final bit of the podcast, we will look at them. So where to start with these memoirs written by those in the ranks? Well, there can really only be one place in my mind to begin, and that's with Frank Richards' Old Soldiers Never Die. Frank Richards was a regular soldier, a Welsh miner, who had served in India before the Great War with the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, and then was a reservist, recalled to the army on the outbreak of war, and went off and went through all 4 years of war, picking up a Distinguished Conduct Medal and a Military Medal along the way. He served in the signal section of his battalion. He served alongside Siegfried Sassoon and Robert Graves. They both had a great admiration for him. And after the war, they encouraged him to write his account. Robert Graves in particular appears to have been very involved in the construction and the editing of the book. There is some suggestion that he may have rewritten one or two bits of it. But it's essentially, when you read it, it's the voice of a common man. And it's a great story. It really is a truly great story that begins and ends, as all great stories do, in a pub, with the soldiers being mobilised, having a beer, and at the end of it, the survivors sit down in the pub together, think of their experiences, toast their fallen comrades, and are drawn to that favourite soldier's song, "Old Soldiers Never Die, They Simply Fade Away." It's an incredibly moving book in places, and one that you can use to follow it on the ground, tracing the places where Frank Richards was, not just in the big battles of the Somme and Ypres and Arras, but in some of those lesser-known sectors. His Distinguished Conduct Medal was for bravery at the Red Dragon Crater at Givenchy, for example, in June of 1916, and you can stand there on that spot and read his account of it. So it's a fantastic, pioneering, really, kind of ordinary soldier's story of the Great War, and was successful and led on to him writing the lesser-known Old Soldier Sahib, which is about his experiences in India before the war. Another classic of British military literature, in my view. A lesser-known story of an ordinary soldier, an account by an ordinary soldier, is Clapham's Mud and Khaki. F.S. Clapham was an ordinary soldier in the Honourable Artillery Company. So he served in the ranks alongside Arthur Pollard, for example. And I don't know if they knew each other or in the same company or ever crossed paths. But again, it's an interesting book to compare Clapham's experiences. And the book mainly covers Ypres 1915. To compare those two experiences, to look at the sector along the Menin Road, around Ypres itself, Saint-de-Loire, and the fighting on the 16th of June 1915 in the attack on the Belawada Ridge. Compare all that to what is in Pollard's book. And again, you begin to build up these layers of knowledge, bringing in these accounts to bring the fields of Flanders and so many other battlefields alive by the stories of those who were there. Clapham's book is not an overwritten account. It's very accessible, easy to read, and there's a lot of detail in it. And precious little is really known about him and what happened to him after his service in the HAC, and why he didn't write about that remains a bit of a mystery, certainly to me. But it's a great account, and one that I kind of see in terms of those individual accounts of Ypres is very much up there and should be read for an understanding of what service in the Ypres Salient was like during those early years of the war. Another good companion to these is 4 Years on the Western Front by a Rifleman. Now, this was a book originally published in the 20s. It's quite a big book, green covered, and it follows the story of an ordinary soldier in the London Rifle Brigade, a rifleman. And that rifleman was Rifleman Aubrey Smith, who went on to be awarded the Military Medal and Bar, which he doesn't mention at all in this memoir. He died in China in the 1930s, and his book was a forgotten kind of gem, really, of the First World War. He was clearly a literate man. The London Rifle Brigade tended to recruit, particularly in its early years, men from a middle-class kind of background. So he's not quite the same as Frank Richards, a working-class Welsh miner, but it is a voice from the ranks, and he goes right through those key battles of the First World War that the London Rifle Brigade were involved in, the fighting at Ypres in 1915, their joining of the London Division, and then he's at Gommecourt on the 1st of July, right through the Somme battles, the fighting at Arras and Ypres and the battles of 1918. And at the end of the book, he comes through the war, he's seen so many comrades fall, and he heads off for demobilisation. And it's quite a moving conclusion where he kind of walks into a hut wearing khaki and comes out the other side in civilian clothes and shuts the door on his war. It's a super book, a really fantastic book. And I have a first edition of it and one of the later reprints. And I think that it adds so much to our knowledge of the London Regiment in the Great War and the 5th Battalion, the London Rifle Brigade, but also tells us so much about some of those key parts of the Great War. Not so much the big battles, but the bits in between. He's very detailed on that. And it's a great read. Giles Eyre was another ordinary soldier author who wrote his memoirs, a book called Somme Harvest, and he serves with the King's Royal Rifle Corps. The book begins in the northern France sector close to Luz. He takes part in a diversionary attack near the Double Crassier, and there's a really, really detailed, quite graphic description of the fighting and death of his comrades in that battle. The book really, in many respects, really doesn't hold much back. It's a very graphic account of fighting and what artillery fire can do to men on a battlefield. And it culminates with an attack on High Wood, that dark corner of the Somme battlefields where so many fell in the summer of 1916. Eyre's book only is a snapshot of the war, a tiny part of it, but yet an important part of it. And it really is a classic Somme memoir. Now, the common thread between all of these books is that they were published in the 1920s and 30s. And one that was from the same period that is a memoir, but a fictionalised memoir. And the use of fiction to convey memory is something that was very common in both World Wars. I think some soldier authors felt that the only way they could relay their experiences was almost to take a kind of third-party view of it, step back from it, and fictionalise their own life. And this was a book that I found in a junk shop many, many years ago. called War, Wine and Women by Wilfrid St. Mond. Now, Wilfrid St. Mond is not his real name. I have no idea who that was in real life. But he appears to have served with a light infantry unit in the 21st Division. And there is some really incredible accounts of the fighting, Loos, when that division suffered such heavy casualties in September 1915, and then their part in the opening phase of the Battle of the Somme. He's a soldier that's decorated for his gallantry, and as the title suggests, we don't just see him memorialising, bringing back the memories of war. There are many accounts of other aspects of a soldier's experience in the estaminets with women behind the lines, and there's a very detailed account of a military execution in the book as well. Because it's fictionalised, I don't think it is complete fiction. There's too much detail in it for it to be made up, but it's very rarely quoted in anything, and it's not a book that, to my knowledge, has ever been reprinted. It's not a rare book, really, or a valuable book, but it is certainly one that is worth getting hold of because it kind of gives a different view of the war, and I think the author, by changing his name and fictionalising his account of the conflict, was able perhaps to put detail in it that the others could not. And jumping on a little way to the 1970s and 80s, this was a period in which, as we mentioned with officers' memoirs, quite a few books, personal accounts of the Great War, were published, some of them by ordinary soldiers. And there were three books that were edited by two authors called Haig and Turner. Haig spelt H-A-I-G-H rather than Douglas Haig. And they did three books, one on a lad who served in the Barnsley Powers who came from Elsica, where I used to live. Another one about a soldier who was in the Queen Victoria Rifles and then in the Royal Naval Division. Both of those accounts really fantastic. Both men commissioned from the ranks who went on to serve as officers. And the third one was The Long Carry by Frank Dunham. Frank Dunham was a stretcher bearer in the 1st 7th London Regiment in the 47th London Division. And it follows him from the Somme through to the end of the conflict. There's a lot about his service in the Ypres salient, life as a stretcher bearer, the realities of the battlefield as a stretcher bearer, and a lot about the battles and the battlefields of 1918. And I know I've used this phrase a lot. It is a classic account and one of only a handful that describes the life and service of stretcher bearers in the Great War. And that makes it, in my mind, a very, very important book. It's one that I've carried with me on many visits to the battlefields, one that I've recommended time and time again. And when I was on a Ledger battlefield tour and coming back home one time, I sat on a feeder coach, one of our coaches that takes us back to where we've come from, and a lady was sitting opposite me on the other side of the coach, and she noticed that I had a battlefield guide top on with a badge, and she said, "Oh, what battlefields have you been to?" And I'd just been on a tour to the Western Front, and was telling her about it, and she said, "Oh, my father served on the Western Front of the Great War. He was a stretcher bearer in the Shiny 7th, which was the nickname of the 7th London Regiment." And I looked at her and I said, "Next thing you'll be telling me is that your father was called Frank Dunham." And when I said that, her eyes nearly popped out of her head, and she said, "How did you know my father's name?" And there in front of me was the daughter of Frank Dunham, the author of The Long Carry. She tried to get the book reprinted during the centenary and sadly failed, and it remains just in that very first 1970s edition. Difficult to get hold of sometimes, but really worth the effort to find it. Another one from this period, and I never got to meet Frank Dunham, but I did meet this author, and that's George Coppard, who wrote With a Machine Gun to Cambrai. Coppard was a teenage Tommy who joined the Queen's Royal West Surreys in 1914 in the 12th Eastern Division and served with them in the early phase of the war on the Western Front in the Battle of Loos. Very good description of that. And then he transfers to the Machine Gun Corps and serves with them until his war ends in the Battle of Cambrai in November of 1917. The book was originally published by the Imperial War Museum. It was a really nice hardback edition of it and quite a nice paperback edition too. And then it's been reprinted, of course, since. He was just an ordinary lad, a working class lad, who had gone through some of the key battles of the Great War, from Loos to the Somme to Arras and Cambrai. but left this very vivid, very honest account of it. And the book to me has really stood the test of time. It's one of those books that I've had for close on 40 years now, and it was great to have that opportunity to meet him in the 1980s. And when I joined the Western Front Association about the same kind of time, quite a lot of the veteran members of the association had begun to write and self-publish their own memoirs. There was a chap called Tanky Taylor who wrote a book about his experiences at Ypres with the Worcestershire Regiment, for example. But the one I wanted to recommend was a book by Frank Hodges, Men of 18 in 1918. And this is an unusual book, because a lot of these memoirs that we've spoken about, almost all of them, if not all of them, are men who were volunteers, who had volunteered in the early period of the Great War. This soldier was a conscript. He was conscripted late on in the conflict and then served in that final year of the war on the Western Front with the 10th Battalion of the Lancashire Fusiliers. It's not a great piece of literature. It's not the work of Siegfried Tassoon. It's the work of an ordinary man who was an 18-year-old Tommy in the trenches in the final battles of the Great War. But it's a classic little account with lots of detail, a really superb ordinary soldier's account of that last period of the fighting on the Western Front. And I suspect, well, I know that there were many other self-published books like this, which I still keep coming across. I've got a whole pile of them by several soldier authors, just ordinary lads, most of whom were ordinary soldiers in the ranks. And some of them are just a few pages. But these are all really important testimony, written many years after, possibly influenced by what some of these men had read and what they'd thought later on. But nevertheless, they are a record of the Great War, and I hope that collections like the Imperial War Museum have quite a lot of them. I know quite a few of these veterans did give copies to institutions like the IWM. But I just wanted to end this section on ordinary soldiers' memoirs with a particular nod to the Canadians, because, curiously, there are quite a few accounts by ordinary soldiers who served with the Canadian Expeditionary Force, the CEF. And top of that list is, of course, the account by Will Bird, who wrote a book that was originally published as And We Go On, and when it was reprinted many years later, it was retitled To Ghosts Have Warm Hands. Now, I've mentioned this book before. Will Bird served in the 42nd Canadian Infantry, Black Watch of Canada. He was awarded the Military Medal for their final battle in November 1918 at Mons, and he went through from the tail end of the Somme through to that final phase of the conflict. He became a journalist, so he was quite a well-read, quite a literate man, but he was not privately educated in the same way that some of these authors that we've spoken about was. But he could tell a story, and that's something that comes across strongly in the book. And that secondary title of Ghosts Have Warm Hands recalls that moment where he was asleep in a dugout, and he felt the warmth of his dead brother's hands. His brother had been killed earlier in the conflict, who kind of dragged him out of this dugout just as a shell came through the pitch black night and went straight through the dugout entrance and killed everybody inside. And there are lots of little cameo stories like this in Will Bird's book. He wrote quite a few others, including one which was a kind of travel book where he went round the battlefields in the 1930s and saw the sites where the Canadians had fought, and then jumping on a generation, he went on to write regimental histories for several Canadian units that served in World War II. A fantastic companion to Will Bird's account is Donald Fraser's The Journal of Private Fraser. Fraser was a Scotsman who'd emigrated to Canada, and he served with the 31st Battalion Canadian Infantry, the Alberta Regiment. I was put onto this book by Lance Catamole, who'd served in the same division as Fraser. And I ordered the book from Canada. It was a book that was published in, I think, the 1980s by an editor. Fraser had long since passed away, and he'd written this account based on his diaries, but it had never been published, and it's been reprinted a couple of times since. Fraser served in the ranks, first in the 31st Battalion and then later in the Canadian Machine Gun Corps, and it follows him as an original member of that battalion from when they arrived on the Western Front in 1915 through service at Ypres, fighting at Courcelette and Regina Trench, and then the battles at Vimy and Passchendaele and the actions of 1918. But it's particularly good on that early period of 1915 when they're holding the line at Ypres. You can really make your way from Saint-Loire down the Messines Ridge with Fraser in hand and visit all these places that he mentions. He spent a lot of time in and around Kemmel, and I mentioned Tony Spagnoli in a recent podcast, and in one of his books he wrote quite a lot about Fraser being in that sector. You could literally almost trace him on the ground, and there's so much detail. He was a great observer, Fraser. He saw so much. There's an account that he gives of seeing the dead of the Gordon Highlanders out in No Man's Land in the Wichita sector. These were men killed there in December 1914. And he goes out at night to recover what he could from the bodies, and he finds dog tags and letters in the pockets of the soldiers. I mean, it's all this kind of detail. And I've read that book again and again. You can dip in and out of it, and you can take so much away every time that you read it. You know, it is, I hate to say, another classic, another book that you really, really do need on your shelves. And when he was out the line, he used to go on what he called cook's tours. So he then describes what he sees when they're resting before they move up to the Somme. He goes for a little walkabouts near Albert, and he visits the Lochnagar crater. And he describes what he sees on the lip of it, the field graves, the names that are on the crosses. It's just an incredible account. And we're both so lucky that Fraser wrote it. And to me, sometimes it's sad that he never saw it published in his lifetime. I think it could have been a classic, really, of that war book period in the interwar period, of which there were so many published then. And our final CEF one that I'll mention is Victor Wheeler, No Man's Land. This was published, I think, in the 1980s, and it's quite a hefty book, quite a thick book. And he was a signaller in the 50th Battalion of the Canadian Infantry. And it goes through from the Somme, a huge amount of material to do with Courcelette, Regina Trench, a lot of descriptions of the conditions on the ground there, and then, of course, Vimy and the later Canadian battles. One or two of the things in it, I think they could have done with a decent editor with this book. There's one or two things that he kind of mixes up a bit of the time frame of what he's talking about, and one or two bits I think are more kind of estaminet stories than the reality of it. But it is an important Canadian account of service in the ranks in an infantry battalion as a signaller during that key second half of Canada's experiences on the Western Front from the Somme through to the end of the conflict. And it's interesting that there are a predominance of these Canadian memoirs. And also when I look, although they're kind of a separate genre, when I look at a lot of the Canadian battalion and unit histories that were published, many of those are written by ordinary soldiers as well. Maybe there was a different feeling in the Canadian forces, that the voice from the ranks was just as important as anyone else. I know that to be an officer in the CEF, you had to be commissioned from the ranks for most of the war, if not all of it. So maybe that generated a kind of different view of what being a Canadian soldier was all about. But as we look back over these different types of memoirs, whether it's artillery forward observation officers or war poets like Sassoon, or ordinary soldiers like Frank Richards or Victor Wheeler or Donald Fraser, I hope that what has come across in this podcast is the importance of these memoirs, whether you read these ones or you find out others that you like, because they will add so much to those layers of our knowledge of the First World War, the layers that cover the Western Front battlefields. And they will fill in so much detail that when we walk those fields, we can think of those words of whatever author it is as we walk up the Bellawada Ridge, down the Menin Road, across the tracks of Courcelette, wherever it is, there are memoirs that will take us back to that time and take us across those crisscross paths of the Great War and understand the landscape that we're seeing through the voices of those men. Many of you listening to this will never have met a Great War veteran, but you can kind of meet them through books like these. And they become characters in your own personal journey. They have for me. And I remember many times with John Dray and Tony Spagnoli and so many others talking about our favourite bits of whatever book it was, and how he'd walked across that ground and traced their route somewhere, whether it was Flanders or the Somme or Luz or wherever it was. So for me, memoirs are the texts by which we almost navigate those pathways of the Great War, how we understand their context and the human experience that surrounds that landscape of the Western Front. The memoirs forever link us, take us back, and enhance all that we know about the old front line. You've been listening to an episode of The Old Front Line with me, military historian Paul Reed. You can follow me on Twitter at SomCor. You can follow the podcast at Old Front Line Pod. Check out the website at oldfrontline.co.uk, where you'll find lots of podcast extras and photographs and links to books that are mentioned in the podcast. And if you feel like supporting us, you can go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/oldfrontline, or support us on Buy Me a Coffee at buymeacoffee.com/oldfrontline. Links to all of these are on our website. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon.